All right, Erev Tov to everyone. Tonight's the 19th of Kislev, November 30th, 2015. This is The President and the Jews, Part 6. I thank Becky and Avi Katz for their sponsorship, Le'ili Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. And tonight we'll examine the lives and times and the Jewish connections of three presidents who served most of the 1840s, William Henry Harrison, John Tyler, and James Knox Polk. Martin Van Buren, the eighth president, was the youngest elected president at the time. He was 54 years old, and he was succeeded by the oldest man to be elected president at the time. William Henry Harrison took office at age 68 and didn't last very long. Now, Harrison was the oldest man elected president until Ronald Reagan, who was a year older at 69. But note, everything is perspective. If Hillary Clinton won, Rahman al-Tzan, she'd be 69. She'd be older than Harrison was when he took office, and even older than Reagan. And Trump would be 70. So he would really be the oldest, although he doesn't look it. The miracle of modern medicine. Now, granted, during Harrison's era, life expectancy at birth was about 30 years. Yeah, 30 years, right. People who spoke had to speak pretty quickly to the audience. But it was because infant mortality was so high. Once you lived, you could live into your 60s or 70s. But Harrison was old, even by his contemporary standards. And he's known primarily for being the first president to die in office and the shortest serving president ever, exactly 1 month. So Harrison was inaugurated on March 4th, 1841. He gave the longest inaugural address ever, an hour and 45 minutes. That'll serve him. In a snowstorm, a driving snowstorm in Washington, without wearing a coat or a hat. His wife wasn't there, by the way, to lecture him. He soon became ill and caught pneumonia, and he died on April 4th, 1841. Why did he speak so long? What did he have to say that was so important? As strange as it sounds, this native of Virginia, who was the last president ever to be born under British rule, had continuing contacts with American Jews. So Harrison was born on February 9th, 1773, the youngest of seven children. At his father's urging, Harrison attended medical school in Philadelphia for 1 year, but he dropped out in 1791 after his father died. He couldn't afford tuition, and he joined the military, which made his career and which made his reputation as well. He was assigned to the Northwest Territory. All right, where do you think that is? The 1790s? The Northwest Territory was the vicinity of Cincinnati, Ohio. And the enemies he fought for most of his life were Indians. In Ohio, he met and married a local girl, Anna. They eloped because her father was opposed to the marriage. When he first met them after they got married, after the wedding, and he inquired how the groom intended to support his daughter, Harrison replied, "By my sword and my own right arm, sir," what you want to hear from any chassan. They had 10 children, including one son, John Scott Harrison, who has the unique distinction of being the only man in American history whose father and son were both presidents. Harrison's grandson, Benjamin Harrison, was the 23rd president, sandwiched between the two terms of New Jersey's own Grover Cleveland. So Harrison served first for 7 years in the Army, and then he found himself in Congress as the representative of the Northwest Territory and then as governor of the Indiana Territory. While in Indiana, he had the most dramatic moment of his life. You know, Yesh Kona Olam B'sho Achas, at least Olam Hazeh, he had the most dramatic moment in his life. He returned to the military as a major general to fight the Shawnee Indian tribe and its chief, Tecumseh, in the Great Battle of Tippecanoe, November 7th, 1811, fought near what is today's Lafayette, Indiana, Harrison's 1,000 men routed the Shawnee, although Tecumseh wasn't present for the battle. This was the turning point for the Shawnee tribe that never recovered. The village was burnt down, the people scattered, the survivors scattered, but what made it controversial is that Tecumseh's brother had come to Harrison the day before with a white flag offering to surrender, and Harrison just rejected it. Now, it was a major victory that Harrison popularized. Tecumseh, who allegedly wanted to live in peace, but without recognizing American sovereignty over his land, which is not quite the same thing, he went on to ally himself with the British the very next year in the War of 1812, and he was killed in battle by Harrison's army fighting in Canada in 1813. But Harrison and Tippecanoe became both synonymous and very famous as well. While in Indiana, Harrison was close with a New York-born Jew named John Hayes, who was a fur trader who had been appointed by Madison as a tax collector. Moreover, as a general in the Indiana militia, Harrison did regular business with two famous Jewish merchants from Philadelphia, the Gratz brothers, Hyman and Simon Gratz. The Gratz parents had come from Austria before the Revolution, raised the family, were very active in Philadelphia. Hyman was the treasurer of Mikveh Israel for more than 30 years. He died in 1856. He and Simon were wholesale grocers, and both did well. Hyman later went into the life insurance business. And they both dealt directly with Harrison, who trusted them and ordered supplies and whatever he needed for his men. Harrison's closest Jewish contact was Dr. Jacob D. LaMotta, born in Charleston, army surgeon during the War of 1812. Now, De LaMotta moved to Savannah, Georgia after the war, where he was horrified at the practices of the Reformed Temple, the only temple in town. De LaMotta was Orthodox, started his own shul, She'erith Israel. At the shul's consecration in 1820, LaMotta spoke. He was serving as the preacher there as well. And he, like Mordechai Manuel Noah, sent copies of his speech to Jefferson and Madison. I've never been tempted to send a copy of my speech to any president, but that's just me. Both Jefferson and Madison responded, extolling the virtues of freedom of religion in the United States. And Jefferson wrote to LaMotta something to think about. He said, "The maxim of civil government being reversed in that of religion, where its true form is, divided we stand, united we fall." Jefferson meant that democracy requires a diversity of views to survive. A uniformity of views means dictatorship, or from his perspective, it meant a religion. A religion can have a uniformity of views, but a democracy should not. Now, LaMotta also practiced medicine in New York for a time, where he became close to Gershon Mendes Seixas, who was a chazan at Sherith Israel in New York City. Seixas was the first to give a sermon in English in the United States. He even gave the first Thanksgiving sermon, I think it was 1790, after the Constitution was adopted. LaMotta even delivered the eulogy, one of the eulogies, at Seixas' funeral in 1816. LaMotta supported Harrison for president in 1840. He himself ran for Congress and lost from Georgia. But he was appointed by Harrison the receiver general for Georgia, and he died in 1845. So Harrison served in the Senate for 4 years, ending in 1828, and then he retired to his home in Ohio. He was officially the clerk of courts in Hamilton County, Ohio, where Cincinnati is, when he first ran for president in 1836 against Martin Van Buren as one of three candidates from the new Whig Party. He lost, but in short order, the Whigs would become a powerful yet fleeting force in American politics. So what were the Whigs? Why the Whigs? Nothing to do with Shaitlach. The simple explanation is that the Whigs were just the anti-Jackson party. The name itself came from the anti-monarchy faction or anti-monarchy movement in Britain in the 18th century. So this was their platform. Whatever Jackson supported, they were against. Whatever he was against, they supported. It's a little simplistic, but only a little. So the party attracted many strong personalities who had in common basically one thing. They all hated Andrew Jackson. It means Daniel Webster, Henry Clay, and William Henry Harrison joined the party as well. It's a very unstable party with different wings. Remember from last week, they ran three candidates in 1836 against Van Buren. They were pro-slavery in the South, and most were anti-slavery in the North. They didn't really have a coherent message. They had four presidents in 20 years. Two were vice presidents who succeeded dead presidents. Lincoln himself grew up as a Whig, and then he became the president from the successor to the Whig Party, known then and now as the Republican Party. All right, Harrison is president. He lost the election of 1836 to Van Buren, but he was enthusiastically supported and endorsed by Mordechai Manuel Noah, that maverick activist, neo-Jewish nationalist and editor. Noah's publication, the New York Evening Star, not only endorsed Harrison, but trumpeted the day after the election, Harrison elected. Shades of Dewey defeats Truman. So Noah wasn't wrong. He was just premature by 4 years. So Harrison then prepared to run again in 1840, and he did. John Quincy Adams, who had a bad word to say about everybody and did not hesitate, said of Harrison, "His thirst for lucrative office is absolutely rabid." Adams wrote these things, by the way, whether or not they were true. He didn't care. He just had a bad word to say about everybody. Harrison benefited from the fact that the Whig Party, shied away from the controversial Henry Clay or Daniel Webster. And his candidacy also benefited from the economic troubles in the wake of the Panic of 1837. The campaign was vicious, much more than anything today. That was a famous song. It's the most famous slogan of the era. Tippecanoe and Tyler too. That was Harrison's positive slogan, which if you think about it, is completely senseless. I mean, the fact that he won a battle 30 years ago against Indians who were outnumbered and offered to surrender doesn't really qualify you to be president. And Tyler, too, makes him seem like an afterthought, which in fact he was. They had a better song also about Van Buren. Van, he's a used-up man. And it had a catchy tune also. The best Van Buren can do, his staff labeled him the pilot that weathered the storm. Not exactly a winning slogan. It was by all accounts a tawdry campaign. Harrison was attacked for being a drunk, and that might have been true as well. Both sides tried to mobilize the rabble through chicanery and lies, and they by and large succeeded. Many people wrote then that this type of election campaign does not bode well for democracy. Something we're all too familiar with today. One interesting side issue was Van Buren's vice president, Richard Johnson. It was an open, and he ran again in 1840. It was an open secret that Johnson lived for years as husband and wife with a mulatto slave, Julia, that he had been given, and with whom he had two daughters, and he didn't hide this. Julia died in 1833. But even before the election, 1836, Johnson began consorting with another slave woman quite openly. She even accompanied him to official functions, and Johnson defended her honor, producing the strange reality that if Van Buren had died in office like Harrison did, the acting first lady would have been a black slave woman. Imagine that. In 1840, Van Buren was clobbered in the election. Harrison won 53-47%, but in the Electoral College, an overwhelming 234-60. And he gave that long speech on March 4th, 1841, about undoing all the policies of Andrew Jackson after 12 years of Jacksonian rule, about reestablishing a national bank and freeing credit to stimulate the economy and awarding jobs on merit rather than patronage. It took me 10 seconds. It took him almost 2 hours, and he paid a price for it. When he died on April 4th, the country obviously was shocked. Never happened before. And in mourning, the first time a president died in office, and it began, an ominous trend in American politics. From 1840 on, every president elected at the 20-year interval died in office. Harrison, Lincoln, Garfield, McKinley, Harding, Roosevelt, Kennedy, and the streak was only broken by Ronald Reagan, with the additional oddity that he was the oldest man ever to serve as president, and he was shot and almost killed. But he survived. Reagan broke the streak, and that streak was continued by George W. Bush. The country grieved upon Harrison's death. At Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia, President Harrison was eulogized by Isaac Leeser, who then published a pamphlet entitled Commemoration of the Life and Death of William Henry Harrison. Whatever else is said, and no matter how long he served, the Jews seem to like him. Harrison was survived by 10 children, but get this, also 48 grandchildren and 106 great-grandchildren, the latter figures the most of any president. So Harrison was succeeded by John Tyler, with obviously number first, the first vice president to become president upon the death of a predecessor, the first person to serve as president never having been elected. Only a handful of others, a short handful. Fillmore, we'll talk about next week, Chester Arthur, and Gerald Ford has the dubious distinction of being the only man who became president not having been elected either president or vice president. It always bothered him, Tyler, when people referred to him as acting president. He even began returning letters unopened that were addressed to him as acting president. And from Harrison being the oldest president, Tyler became the youngest president at 51 years old, nor did he name a vice president during his entire terms. He became the first president to do that. In his national declaration of mourning, Tyler called upon the nation to grieve as a proper Christian nation, that phrase, Christian nation, and that provoked the ire of a Jew in Richmond, Virginia, a nobleman, notable Jew named Jacob Ezekiel, who sent a letter to Tyler objecting to his use of the term. And Tyler replied very cordially that he meant no offense. I quote, "I designed in nothing to exclude any portion of my fellow citizens from a cordial union in the solemnities of that occasion. In speaking in the first paragraph of the duties of a Christian people, I meant in no way to imply that similar duties should not be performed by all mankind. For the people of whom you are one, I can feel none other than profound respect." And then he continued, I quote, "The wisdom which flowed from the lips of your prophets has in time past and will continue for all time to come to be a refreshing fountain of moral instruction to mankind. While holy records bear witness of divine favors and protection of the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, God of the Christian and Israelite, to his chosen people. May I then hope, sir, that this explanation will remove all difficulties, and that your voice and the voices of all your brethren will ascend to our common Father in supplication and prayer on the day I have suggested." Signed, John Tyler. Very beautiful sentiment indeed. Tyler, like Harrison, was an Episcopalian, born in Virginia, March 29th, 1790, grew up on a Virginia plantation in a well-to-do family. He attended William and Mary College, was a good student, became a lawyer, and soon after, a politician in a variety of capacities, state legislator, congressman, governor, then U.S. senator, and he joined, at the time, the only functioning party during the Monroe era, the Democratic-Republican Party, but he disagreed with Andrew Jackson on some major issues, mainly the nullification question. Tyler supported South Carolina's right to secede, and in the 1830s he became active in the new Whig Party. Tyler had an equivocal relationship with the slavery question. He was a slave owner himself, allegedly treated his slaves well, but he was a strict constructionist who held that it would be unconstitutional to abolish slavery. He opposed the Missouri Compromise, but Tyler supported states' rights in a more responsible way than other Whigs, because he also deferred to the supremacy of the Constitution. Tyler did think that slavery was evil. He never sought to justify it, hoping, he once wrote, it would just go away quietly and without fuss. Well, of course it didn't, and nor did Tyler free any of his slaves, as, for example, Polk did. His success was that he was seen as a principled person who was a counterweight to Henry Clay, who scared and or annoyed many people. In fact, it was Clay who engineered Tyler's return to the Senate in the 1830s, but Tyler resigned on principle instead of voting to censure Andrew Jackson as the Virginia legislature had demanded. So he was out of politics. Well, there are second acts in American politics. And Tyler became a compromise choice for vice president in 1840, mainly to mollify supporters of Henry Clay, who was denied the nomination he coveted. Tyler and Harrison, oddly enough, were born in the same county in Virginia and had similar backgrounds. So Tyler served the shortest term ever as vice president, and in his 1 month, he was completely uninvolved. He wasn't even in Washington most of the time. He was not consulted at all about cabinet appointments, and if Harrison's detractors felt that Harrison was a non-entity, then even less use for Tyler. The Whigs, for their part, thought that both Harrison and Tyler could be easily controlled. Tyler received the news by letter that Harrison had died and he had become president while on the floor of his home in Williamsburg, Virginia, playing marbles with his children. And Harrison had the most grandchildren and great-grandchildren. No president had more children than John Tyler, a total of 15 from two wives separately, not the same time. So he and his wife, Letitia, had 8 children, but she suffered a stroke in 1839 and never fully recovered. She died in the White House in 1842. She was the first lady of 3 to die in the White House. Tyler, then 54 years old, somehow met and married a 24-year-old woman whom he described as a raven-haired beauty, Julia Gardner, 30 years younger than he was. They married in 1844 while he was president, the first president to marry in the White House. Even that is a story. So she was reluctant to marry a man much older than she was. So Tyler, courting her, invited Julia and her father, New York Congressman David Gardner, to cruise down the Potomac with him on the USS Princeton, celebrating the completion of the treaty with Texas. The ship had on board the country's largest naval gun, which they fired several times in celebratory fashion. The last shot exploded on board. Tyler was below deck, so he was unhurt, but several people were killed, including David Gardner, Julia's father. In grief, Julia married John Tyler just a few months later. They had 7 children together, the youngest of whom, I mean, I was really amazed when I saw this. Yeah, they had a daughter born in 1860, just 2 years before Tyler died, named Pearl Tyler Ellis. She lived until 1947. So that's longevity, father and daughter. Tyler was born 1790 when Washington was president, and his daughter died when Truman was president in 1947. That's an amazing time span. Now, one book records that Tyler has grandchildren who are still living, but it's too much. I just crunched the numbers. There are 2 descendants. They said a grandchildren, one born in 1924, one born in 1928. But that would mean his youngest daughter gave birth when she was 68 years old. I would have heard of that if that were true. So they're likely great-grandchildren, which is also something. So Tyler still has great-grandchildren who are alive today in their 80s. Now, when Harrison died, it was not entirely clear what Tyler was. The first time, but this set the pattern for American history. See, he was first referred to as vice president, acting as president. But Tyler was proud, strong-willed, and well-educated, and he immediately saw himself as president and beholden to no one. But it really was the great unknown and took some time for the dust to settle. The Constitution, Article 2, reads, I'll just read the pertinent part, in case of death, or inability to discharge the powers and duties of said office, the same shall devolve upon the vice president. Well, what does that mean, the same shall devolve? Did the succession mean that the vice president was the president? or that he merely had the powers and duties of the president. It's a shame they didn't ask Reb Chaim to dissect at the time he was alive what the Constitution meant. Was a special election necessary? No one really knew. There had been several legal studies published in the 1820s that indicated that the vice president becomes the president. End of discussion. Compounding the problem, this was an era going on almost 30 years in which Congress saw itself as the major power in the federal government, the exact opposite of what it is today. So Congress said they would decide, and now you had the tension. At first, the cabinet decided Tyler was president. He took the oath of office on April 6, 1941, and then began 2 months of arguing. On May 31st, the House passed a resolution acceding to Tyler as president, followed by the Senate soon after, which recognized Tyler as president by a vote of 38-8. And so it was, but it didn't stop Tyler's enemies from referring to him throughout his term as his accidency, as if he's just an accident, did not deserve to be president. So Tyler really struggled as president for that and other reasons. He lacked a political base. The Whig Party was always fractured, and even if Tyler kept at first Harrison's cabinet, the most powerful figure in that cabinet, Daniel Webster, the Secretary of State, yearned to be president. It was not a healthy dynamic. And Tyler fought with the Whigs and had a falling out with them over issues related to government finances and tariffs and even the annexation of Texas. So Tyler became the first president against whom an impeachment bill was proffered in the House, and by his own party, no less. It failed, but it just, he had no base. Both parties in Congress opposed him. Tyler tried to annex Texas without officially accepting Texas as a slave state. He said they could decide on their own. And Congress, including his own Whigs, voted down the treaty. It will be submitted again by Tyler the day before he left office and signed by his successor, Polk, who was pro-annexation. So Tyler hoped to ride the annexation wave to victory in 1844. He did apply the Monroe Doctrine to Hawaii, pleasing generations of American vacationers, but it didn't work for him. By the time the election came around, Tyler really was a man without a party. So the Whigs nominated, finally, Henry Clay as their candidate, and he was soundly defeated by the Democratic-Republican candidate, the Speaker of the House, James Knox Polk. Tyler retired to his plantation. He sired 7 more children. He tried to prevent the outbreak of the Civil War. Failing in that, he joined the Confederate Congress, the only such president to do that. And when he died in 1862, he became the only president whose death was not acknowledged in Washington, having gone over to the dark side. So Tyler is buried in Richmond, just a few yards from the grave of James Monroe. All right, what about the Jews? Well, in 1844, Tyler appointed a man named Warder Cresson, a Quaker from Philadelphia, as the first U.S. consul in Yerushalayim. Cresson was a fascinating character, perhaps a little off, perhaps not. He served 4 years in Israel after leaving his wife and 6 children back home. He was a bit eccentric. He was imbued with the Christian fervor that was sweeping a good part of the nation at the time, that the time had come to renew Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. So he petitioned Tyler for this post, the first time any American held it. He went to Yerushalayim, he took the poor Jews of Yerushalayim under his wing, and he promised them America's protection. Remember, of course, just 4 years after the blood libel of Damascus. After a short time, the State Department revoked his commission. Cresson stayed on anyway. John C. Calhoun, then the Secretary of State, said of Warder Cresson, he is of weak mind, and what there is of that mind is quite out of order. Well, he stayed on anyway, and while there he converted to Judaism, Kedasu Kedin, becoming a Ger Tzedek. He had a bris milah, took the name Michael Boaz Yisrael ben Avram Avinu, and he returned to his Quaker wife and children in America, a frum Jew. All right, they're a little surprised. his Quaker family tried to have him committed to an insane asylum, and they went to court to prove that he was out of his mind. Mordechai Manuel Noah submitted an affidavit to the court in which he wrote, quote, that a Christian court would decide that adopting Judaism as a religion is proof of insanity, we can never believe. Whatever happened to the court, Crescent escaped, and he returned to Israel, where he lived out his life as a Torah Jew, promoting Jewish settlement, and even sponsoring agricultural work in what today is Rehov Emek Rephaim. Not much came of it, but it did plant seeds for the future, and always retained the vision of impending Jewish statehood. The next consul was not appointed until some 20 years later as a Christian doctor from Boston, and he could not handle the diseases or the intrigues of Yerushalayim, and he succumbed to alcoholism. Tyler also replied to an American Jew named Joseph Simpson. It's interesting, Jews were already becoming assertive. Simpson wrote to complain that Winfield Scott, famous general of the army, was going to speak at a conference of Christian missionaries. Now, there's nothing wrong with it, but listen how Tyler responded. Tyler said he thought there's nothing wrong with it, except when Scott speaks, quote, it will not and cannot be in his character as general-in-chief of the army. He has to lay down his sword and epaulets and speak as a distinguished citizen and nothing more. And he explained, just like if he were a Hebrew and of the same tribe as yourself, he could appear in synagogue if permitted, and that would in no way affect him in his military character. But he went on to say that the United States have adventured upon a great and noble experiment, that of total separation of church and state. Quote, no religious establishment by law exists among us. The conscience is left free from restraint, and each is permitted to worship his maker after his own judgment. The offices of government are open alike to all. So said John Tyler. Then he continued his beautiful words. And Tyler, you see, knew Jewish history and he knew the Bible as well. He said, I quote, the Hebrew, persecuted and downtrodden in other regions, takes up his abode among us with none to make him afraid. He may boast, as well he can, of his descent from the patriarchs of old, of his wise men in council and strong men in battle. He may evermore turn his eye to Judea, resting with confidence on the promise made him of his restoration to that holy land. And he may worship the God of his father after the manner that that worship was conducted by Aaron and his successors in the priesthood. And the aegis of government is over him to defend and protect him. And he concluded that while he remains connected to government, you can be assured the guarantees of the Constitution in that great particular will know no diminution. Tyler, like most of his predecessors and some of his successors, had to deal with Uriah Phillips Levy, whose name seems to come up every week, the American Jewish naval officer who was court-martialed repeatedly on bogus charges. So Levy was now commanding the USS Vandalia, and shockingly for his time, he banned the practice of flogging as a punishment for Navy men who had misbehaved. Maybe even more shockingly, he substituted a different punishment. A 16-year-old boy who mimicked an officer, disrespectful. And instead of flogging him, Levy had him tied to the ship's gun, stripped naked, and tarred and feathered. So he was court-martialed again, found guilty, and dismissed from the Navy. Tyler was informed of the whole Levy history, and he ruled that what Levy did was disgraceful, his motives were good, and the punishment is not as bad as flogging. So Tyler reinstated Levy, well aware of the way the Navy mistreated him over the years, suspended him for 1 year, and promoted him to captain. And we will yet hear from Uriah Phillips Levy again. Tyler was out 1845, succeeded by James Knox Polk, one of my favorite presidents, and one of history's most underrated presidents. Polk has the unique distinction of running for office, promising to do four things, doing those four things, and having pledged not to run for a second term not running again. And those are all exceedingly rare in politics. Polk was born in North Carolina in 1795, the oldest of 10 children, but he's most identified with Tennessee, where his family moved when he was just 10 years old. There he studied law, joined the militia, became a congressman, became Speaker of the House, later governor of Tennessee. Polk is the only Speaker of the House ever to become president. Memo to Paul Ryan. Now, he was considered very refined for his time. He never challenged, you can even see in his pictures, very distinguished looking, never challenged anyone to a duel, which was unusual for the time, despite the persistent insults he endured. And you read about it, some were quite vicious. He married and never had any children, likely because of a brutal operation he endured as a teenager without anesthesia to remove urinary stones. Don't even try to think about it. Now, Polk had an interesting religious background. He was as an infant, he was denied baptism as a Presbyterian when his father refused to affirm the Christian faith in church. So Polk was not baptized until he was on his deathbed. But he often accompanied his wife to church. And he would occasionally write in his diary his thoughts about the quality of the preacher's sermon. As one historian notes, more as a theater critic than as a worshiper. But he believed in God, and he believed as strongly in the separation of church and state, noting several times, "Thank God for it," and commenting that he made his presidential appointments without regard to the creed of the appointee. Now, Polk was a dark horse candidate in 1845. I think the term was invented for him. He was officially out of politics, but hoped to be considered for vice president. His main opponent for the nomination was Martin Van Buren, who was trying to get back in the game to redeem himself after losing so badly in 1840. And Calhoun was running, and James Buchanan, we'll hear from next time, was running as well. The opening for Polk came because both Van Buren, as the Democratic-Republican side, and Clay, of the Whig side, came out publicly against the annexation of Texas and U.S. expansion, and that became Polk's ticket to the presidency. He was a big believer in manifest destiny. It was the destiny of America to stretch from sea to shining sea, I should add. And the country was still enthralled with the saga of the fall of the Alamo that had occurred just 8 years earlier. So at the convention, Van Buren won a majority on the first ballot, but not the two-thirds necessary. Polk didn't even get a vote on the first ballot. Support then switched to General Lewis Cass, and then finally to Polk, coming up on the outside, who was supported, fellow Tennessean, by an aging Andrew Jackson, and Polk won on the ninth ballot. Polk faced Clay, Henry Clay, in the election. Why? Polk was Jackson's protege, and Jackson felt that Polk had the best chance of defeating his sworn enemy, Henry Clay. That's why he supported him. And in fact, Polk won, defeated Clay in a very close election, 49.5% to 48.1%, 170 to 105 in the Electoral College, but only a 39,000 vote differential in the popular vote, in which less than 2.6 million people voted. It was a vicious campaign. Here's a Jewish reference for you. Clay wrote that during the campaign, he feels he's been charged with every crime enumerated in the Decalogue, the Aseret HaDibros, and it was probably true. Polk was accused of branding his initials on 40 of his slaves, but that was a falsehood so blatant and so easily disproved that the newspapers had to print a retraction, and that helped Polk. Polk was a year younger than Tyler, so he became the youngest president to date, 49, when he took office. That being said, Polk took office unencumbered by anyone. Remember, dark horse candidate, he wanted to be the vice president in 1844, saying he didn't need the position, he didn't seek the position, but he wouldn't decline it if the people wanted him. And he had very straightforward goals as president. Four, he wanted to reduce tariffs to acquire the Oregon Territory from Britain, that then was the Northwest Territory, to create an independent treasury that would safeguard the nation's money and to further enlarge the United States by adding the Southwest especially California, by buying it from Mexico. That was his platform. He did all of that. Polk was a perfectionist. He was a workaholic. He never took a vacation. He was able to bring California into the United States by responding to Mexico's provocation, declaring war, winning a stunning victory, the Mexican War, 1846 to 1848. And Polk himself expanded America's territory by one-third, and then he went home. And by the end of Polk's term in 1849, almost all of today's continental United States was under American sovereignty. So originally wanted to buy California from Mexico. I think they're buying it back, by the way. But Mexico rejected it. And there was an incident where allegedly Mexican forces attacked American forces at the Rio Grande River under the command of General Zachary Taylor. When 11 American soldiers were killed, Polk asked Congress for a declaration of war. Congress complied. The war was not universally popular. Many Whigs, including Abraham Lincoln, opposed it, and they even challenged the story that amounted to the casus belli. In fact, it bears a great similarity to the Gulf of Tonkin business during the LBJ administration. But the U.S. won a great victory in a war. 2 years ended with a Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. America had expanded. Many of the generals who would fight in the Civil War got their combat experience in Mexico. Until today, there's an American military cemetery in Mexico City with more than 1,300 graves. And even the Whigs who criticized the war did not hesitate to nominate Zachary Taylor, war hero, as their candidate in 1848. So the war, as victorious wars usually do, sparked a wave of patriotism and good feeling throughout the country that also redounds to Polk's credit. People then saw the contours of a great nation bordered east and west by two great oceans. True to his word, Polk did not run for a second term. Just as well, very sadly, he took ill just 3 months after his term ended, and he died June 15th, 1849, age 53, at the time the youngest president or former president ever to die. So his wife, Sarah, was widowed for another 42 years. Polk didn't have an extensive history with Jews, but he did interact with some. One of them, another character, David Na'ar, born in the Virgin Islands, became a prominent businessman and was appointed by Polk as the commercial attaché in his hometown of St. Thomas. And after that, he was elected the very first Jewish mayor of Elizabeth, New Jersey, right down the road. There's a very interesting encounter also. Isaac Mayer Wise, the famed American Reform rabbi, was in Washington for some reason during Polk's administration, and a mutual acquaintance asked him, does he know Polk? And Wise said, no, he would like to meet him. And the fellow said, okay, let's go. And those were the days the White House was just open. You could just walk in. It ended after Lincoln was shot. But even when Lincoln was the president, Lincoln would open his bedroom door in the morning and there'd be people sitting outside asking him for jobs. All right, they didn't bother him while he was sleeping, but they'd be inside the White House. They walked into the White House. They walked into Polk's office. Polk had their back to them, so the friend turned to the president. Mr. President, I'd like you to meet someone. And introduced them to Wise. And Polk said to Wise, is this the first time you're meeting a president? And Wise said, yes, Mr. President, but I'm willing to wager it's the first time you have met someone like me. And Polk said, what are you? And he said, I'm a rabbi. And Polk was overcome by it, and he said, indeed, he'd never met a rabbi before, and he spoke very warmly of Jews, and again of the American treatment of Jews, both in real terms and in a constitutional sense. All right, finally, just a few words about slavery and the Jewish people. Each of the presidents during this era, which the three we discuss tonight, or the four we'll discuss next time, did little more than kick the slavery can down the road. It really had no happy solution. No candidate for president could win as an outright abolitionist on the one hand, nor as a lover of slavery on the other hand. Everyone had to try to thread the needle of being against it but tolerant of it. And Polk was typical of his generation. He had slaves. His wife even used some of his slaves to make repairs in the White House in order to save money. But Polk also considered slavery evil, and he wrote that blacks were rational human beings, not something that everyone maintained. And what about the Jews? So for the last 20, 30 years, black liberationists, Jew haters, have been writing that Jews were big slave traders, critical to the slave trade, slave owners, etc. It's a complete falsehood, although it's equally false to state that Jews were uninvolved. The truth is that no one has clean hands when it comes to slavery. It was the blacks in Africa who were rounding up their own and sold them, white Europeans, including some Jews, who were the traders, and American Southerners, by and large non-Jews, who were the purchasers in this context. Now, the truth is that Jews were much more involved in the slave trade in the 1600s and 1700s in Brazil, or Curacao, or Suriname, meaning South America or Central America, than they were in the U.S. And many of those Jews were not necessarily Jews, but conversos, or in fact Jews who had converted to Christianity and were called New Christians. And remember, of course, Jewish involvement in Europe was largely due to the fact that Jews were overrepresented in the merchant class, because in most of Europe they were not allowed to own land or join many guilds. And the slave trade originated in Portugal and the Netherlands, where conversos were also overrepresented. In America, Jewish involvement was minimal. So, for example, in 1830, of 11,000 Southerners who owned more than 50 slaves, only 4 were Jews. Jews did have a high percentage of slave ownership in the South, because Jews generally lived in urban areas like Charleston, and city dwellers always had a high rate of slave ownership, but in terms of ownership, they had relatively few slaves. But the slaves who worked in the cities were more like household servants or even employees in business than they were like plantation slaves who lived in dreadful conditions. So none of this justifies slavery in the least, but the percentage of Jewish slave ownership was less than the rest of the population. And as it turned out, Jews in the North began to differ with Jews in the South as to the merits of slavery. The net effect of Jews on the institution of American slavery was minuscule. Jewish attitudes on slavery then paralleled non-Jewish attitudes. Understandable when one considers the dearth of Torah knowledge that existed in America at the time. Certainly slavery in the South did not at all compare with the institution of Avdus that the Torah describes. Certainly not the Eved Ivri, but even not the Eved Kanani, in which the Eved Kanani is treated more like a member of the family. He's even obligated in certain mitzvahs. That's how he's treated, not as a subhuman. But all the presidents we've discussed made their peace with slavery. We can sit in judgment of them, but at our peril. America would fight a war to end the institution of slavery, and Jews would have a role in that war as well on both sides. But next time we'll look at the different Jewish views on slavery as it evolved during those times. And we'll look at also what I like to call the mediocrities, the 4 presidents, Taylor, Fillmore, Pierce, and Buchanan, whose weaknesses were triggers for the war between the states, still the bloodiest war in American history. That'll be in 2 weeks. Next week is Hanukkah, so happy Hanukkah to everybody.